Mike Carlton, AM, media commentator, radio host. You've got a list here, television journalist, ABC war correspondent. You've been an author, newspaper columnist. And welcome to the Last Post radio show podcast series.
Thank you kindly. Nice to be here.
Yes, it's good to have you aboard. And we're here, of course, to talk about your latest, greatest book, Dive, Australian Submarines at War. What inspired you? I mean, I know that you've had quite a few books on naval history, I think four from memory. What inspired you to turn down the track here and write about submarines?
Well, I was this sounds a bit up myself, but I was actually having a cup of coffee with the Chief of Navy, the man who runs the show, Vice Admiral Mark Hammond. We never met. He invited me for a cup of coffee. And that's all it was. And he said, "Are you thinking of another book?" And I said, "Oh, maybe I don't know what I'd write about. I haven't got a subject in mind." And he said, "Well, what about submarines?" Now, it just happens that he's an ex-submariner, just the second submariner ever to get the top job in the Navy. And he suggested it. And I'm a bit cautious because I'm a bit reluctant because I knew nothing about submarines except they, you know, go underwater. But the more I dug into it and looked around, the more I realised what a great story it is, Australian submariners. They are great people, interesting stories, and worth telling.
I remember as a youngster being particularly drawn to submarines whenever navies would come to town, would go and have a look at the submarines, etc. What is it? Is it a particular culture in the submarines that's different from the rest of the Navy?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. They are an elite group, I suppose you could say. They wouldn't call themselves that, but they know they are, because it is a very, very demanding and frequently dangerous job. It's very different to being in a surface vessel where you've got, you know, lots of fresh air and sunshine. Underwater, the chances of something going wrong are higher. And if something does go wrong, it can be fatal. It's as simple as that. I mean, if a surface ship, a, you know, destroyer or a frigate or something, loses engine power for whatever reason, it just floats, just sits there and floats. Bit annoying, but much is going to happen. The submarine loses all power; it goes to the bottom. That's it. Boom. And if it's deep enough, the submarine is crushed, and so are the people in it.
Yeah, incredible stuff indeed.
So they know this. They know that they take a risk when they go. In fact, they have a saying that every time we go to sea, we go to war, which sounds a bit sort of pompous and pretentious, but they mean it because they are prepared for any and every eventuality.
Yeah, I was particularly, I guess, a law unto themselves in some way with their dress codes and manner on board.
That's changed a bit over the years. It used to be a bit of a free for all. There's always a bit of a hint of the pirate about submariners. You know, not quite a parrot on the shoulder and earrings, but there's a bit of a larrikin element to them. I think it's fair to say. Oxley was one of what they call the O class boats or Oberon class boats, which we bought in the 1960s. We bought six of them, and they were pretty good. They were British boats, and they were pretty much state of the art for the time. She was one of them, and away they went. Those boats sort of took part in the Cold War. They didn't shoot anybody, or get into a shooting war. But there was a lot of dancing around with particularly the Soviet Navy in the South China Sea and in the Pacific in those days, and Australian submarines then kept an eye on them.
For those that may not know, and of course, I guess that includes you before you got so deeply involved in learning more about submarines, Mike, where did submarines actually start? I have a feeling it was River Thames or something from 400.
Yes. I can't remember the date now, it was 16 something. And a Dutchman named Cornelius Drebbel took a boat down the Thames, I think from, Westminster in the direction of Greenwich or something. And there were several different and varying accounts of it. So it obviously did happen. It wasn't just fiction or rumour. And it travelled underwater with enough light, they said, inside that you could actually read the Bible, should you be so minded. And it was powered by oars, so it was submerged somehow. and the details aren't all that specific. But it did actually travel underwater, so much so that the king himself, one of the Stuart kings, James, I think it was, actually went for a ride. And this was acknowledged to be the first submarine, the first genuine boat that actually traveled some distance underwater. And then throughout the following years, nothing much happened until around the American Civil War, the Americans started to get interested in it. Submarines as a means of attacking the British fleet. The American Revolutionary War. And the Americans thought, well, they didn't have anything like the British Royal Navy, anything like the British fleet, but a couple of submarines might help out. And so they had a go at that. And the Americans took it quite seriously. While the French built boats, they were inspired by, I don't know, you probably know it, that Jules Verne novel, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Classic book.
And so through the 19th century, the idea of submarines gradually took shape and they began to develop them.
Look, Mike, I guess we're well known as a girth by sea, et cetera, but as a maritime nation, should we be more up on the subject of submarines?
I tend to think so. I mean, they are actually the spear point of our defence. They're the front line, if you like. That's one of the things they're there for. But a lot of what they do is not known, because a lot of what they do is still secret, even to this day.
Yeah.
We're not told a lot of what they do, but you can put it down to intelligence gathering and watching and listening and waiting is a lot of it.
Yeah.
Australians are becoming a bit more submarine conscious because of AUKUS, of course, because that's in the future and that's going to cost us quite a few billion dollars. So I guess submarines are a bit more of the fore these days, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. It's become more of a general talking topic now. Australia didn't really seem interested in submarines. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but until Deakin came along as PM?
Yeah, well, at the turn of at Federation, we were very keen to have a navy of our own. And it was both sides of politics, both the conservative side, which was Alfred Deakin, and the Labor side, which was Andrew Fisher. They agreed on that, that it'd be a good idea if Australia had its own navy, which was a ridiculous idea in one sense. So there's a tiny colony, a tiny ex-colony of, 5 or 6 million people or something. The idea that we should have a navy was seen absurd, except that it wasn't absurd. It was great. It was a terrific idea. And we shouldered the burden of our own defences. We bought a bloody great big battle cruiser, some destroyers, and two submarines from the British named AE1 and AE2. The A stood for Australia.
That's right.
They were there in good time for the First World War.
That's right, and things changed then. We actually lent some sailors from England.
Well, we had to, because we didn't have too many Australians who were qualified either to command, certainly not to command a submarine, but not to sail one either. All that much, a few. So we sent a lot of Australians over to Britain to learn the ropes as quickly as we could. But those first two submarines, AE1 and AE2, were commanded by British Royal Navy officers. Yeah.
Was Harry Stoker one of them? Was Harry Stoker involved in that?
Yeah. Harry Stoker was the captain of AE2. He was actually an Irishman.
That's right.
And a fabulous, fabulous character. I mean, he was a bon vivant. He loved life. He chased women. He was also a very good submarine officer.
That's right.
But he led a charmed life. And he took AE2 in an attack upon the Turks on Anzac Day 1915, the 25th of April 1915. He took AE2 up through the narrow Dardanelles Strait with Turkey on either side into the Sea of Marmara, which is virtually a Turkish lake. And it was an extraordinary feat. He had to pass through a minefield to do it. He could have been blown up at any minute if he got it wrong. And he actually was the first, he and his boat, the Australian submarine, were the first in on Anzac Day. Not the Army, but the Australian Navy submarine.
And we don't hear much about that.
Well, it was a long time ago, wasn't it? 1915. But it was an extraordinary feat of navigation alone and of courage. And his orders were to run amok. And the idea was that he'd go around sinking Turkish transport by sea, carrying ammunition and food and supplies to the Turkish armies above Gallipoli. And that's what he did. He ran amok for a few days and caused all sorts of mayhem until they finally got him. The Turks finally got him, and he had to sink the submarine, and they all ended up as prisoners of war.
It's such an interesting story, an interesting character. What the first casualties in World War One were actually sailors. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the very first casualty was a sailor on land up in what's now Papua New Guinea. But it used to be, I mean, this is something most Australians aren't aware of either, but there was a huge German colony up there in what's now Papua New Guinea. It was German New Guinea. It was part of the Kaiser's Empire.
And is that the East Asia Squadron or...?
Yeah, well, the German East Asia Squadron was the German East Asia Squadron was actually based out of China, but it controlled the Kaiser's empire in the Western Pacific, which was a large chunk of New Guinea, including Rabaul. They had other islands there as well. They had Nauru for a bit, and we decided, or the British decided for us, really, that should be shut down at the start of. Start of the First World War, 1914. So we banged together some soldiers and sailors and sent them off up there to do it. The first to die was actually a young sailor. The great tragedy was one of the submarines was lost as well, the first a few weeks old. And she went out on patrol one day and never came back. And for more than 100 years, she was not found. Nobody knew what had happened to her. Eventually, there were search parties and, you know, as technology improved, more and more intensive searching went on. But finally they found it buried very, very deep, and of course a war grave, so she wasn't disturbed, but she lies up there still, AE1.
I guess we move forward, I guess, but by the end of World War II, Mike, I think we had, what was it, the fourth largest navy in the world?
Yeah, well, largely because the Germans and the Japanese had been pretty much wiped out. So yeah. I think the biggest navy was probably still the British, maybe the Americans. It was British, Americans, Canadians, and us. The navy's never been bigger. I can't remember how many men and ships that had them, but it was huge, yeah. Mm. But we didn't have any submarines in the Second World War, not one. But we sent lots of Australians off to Britain to join the Royal Navy, one reason or another. And a lot of them wound up in what were known as midget submarines, which were, you know, not much longer than a cricket pitch, with a crew of originally of three and then of four and sometimes five. Right. And their job was to do things like sneaking into harbours and launching explosive attacks on German battleships, that sort of thing. Mm. And a lot of Australians served in those things with incredible courage and distinction. They're a great story too. There was a German battleship called the Tirpitz, pretty much the pride of the Nazi Navy, and it was hidden away in a fjord in the far north of Norway. And six of these little midget submarines set out from Scotland to try and blow her up. And there was a lot of Australians on that mission. In fact, two of the six submarines were commanded by Australians, one of whom was killed on the job. But their stories of how they, you know, snuck into fjords and planted explosives beneath enemy shipping and so on are quite staggering stuff.
Yeah, incredible. I suppose, as you mentioned in the book, there is a lack of concentration perhaps on the naval history as compared to the land battles by the mere fact that more Australians died on land, so that may be the cause of that. But these stories are all very interesting and have their own heroics within the stories, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of these midget submariners was a bloke called Max Sheehan. Mm. He was a young bloke from Perth in his early 20s. He eventually ended up captaining a couple of these midget submarines. I'll tell you two things he did, which still astonish me. They were on their way to Norway, they're up in the Arctic Circle, in the Arctic Ocean, where the water temperature was about 4 or 5 degrees. And one of the little midgets went missing and it just vanished and disappeared. And so they lost that. They were being towed by bigger submarines. Now, Sheehan was on board one of the bigger submarines and they said, look, it seems we've got the tow rope snarled around our propellers. You're going to have to go down and have a look. And he didn't have his diving gear with him. He just had, so he put on a pair of ordinary old overalls and dived overboard in 5 degree water to try and untangle this rope from the submarine's screws, in which he did. But the captain said to me, he said, you better be quick, because if an aircraft comes along, I'm going to submerge, and would have left him there. So he dives into this freezing water wearing nothing more than a pair of overalls and somehow manages to untangle the rope from around the submarine screws, then clambers back on board again.
What a hero.
another trick. This was much later in the war, 1945, almost war's end.
Mm.
They set off in a midget submarine. He was captaining by that stage. Set off in a midget submarine to cut the communications cable that ran between Tokyo and Singapore. And they're going to cut it off the Saigon River, off Vietnam. So they're on their way there, and he's on deck on this little midget submarine, which, as I said, is not much bigger than a cricket pitch. You know, it's that long. And he's washed overboard. And nobody knows. He's just, waves that went a whoosh, and he lost his balance, and away he went. In the middle of the South China Sea, everyone else is below decks, and so he swims after it. Now this little thing's only going about 4 knots, you know, it's crawling pace, and he's almost loses it. By luck, he manages to fling out an arm and catch a bit of wire on the deck of the submarine, and he hauls himself back on board. But if he hadn't done that, he would have been lost. They would have never have, you know, they might have, if they hadn't discovered him 2 or 3 hours later or something, he probably would have drowned and just vanished. So that's the sort of thing they did.
Mike, I can see a few movies being made out of this.
You'd reckon, wouldn't you? There would be a great story in that scene.
Between the end of World War II and the Cold War, things were moving along at a fair pace. I suppose we had Vietnam looming and all that sort of stuff as well. So how did things happen then? Were things changing at a pace then, or were we still dragging our tail a bit?
Well, after the Second World War, the Navy sort of split into two camps a bit. There were those people who wanted aircraft carriers, because they were all the rage at the time.
That's right.
And so we bought two of those, Sydney and Melbourne, HMAS Sydney, HMAS Melbourne, with the aircraft to go with them. And they fought in Korea. But the other another part of the Navy definitely wanted submarines, and it was realised actually that we actually did need them. Things were starting to get a little tense up north. The rise of China was just beginning to happen, but at the time in the early 60s, more concerned about Indonesia. So submarines were seen as a much cheaper alternative to aircraft carriers, God knows. And so that's why we bought six of those boats we mentioned earlier, the Oberon-class boats.
I guess the American was a bit of an arms race with submarines between the Americans and Russians.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, after the war, the Americans went nuclear. They realised that they could have nuclear powered submarines that could do all sorts of things that the old diesel boats couldn't do. Stay underwater indefinitely. I mean, a nuclear boat can stay underwater basically until the food runs out. That's the only limit on its endurance, really. And so the Americans developed and built nuclear submarines, type up different ones, missile-carrying submarines and ballistic missile-carrying submarines, and as well. And so there was this arms race. The Russians joined in and they built their own nuclear submarines. I mean, the Russians built huge, huge nuclear boats, 10,000-ton submarine, which is a very, very big ship. This arms race was on.
Yeah, what a turning circle that it had.
So
finally, I guess, Mike, this amazing book, Dive, and I'd recommend people get out there and have a read it for all historians.
Thank you.
And those who are interested in our history, not only war history, but politically and a whole lot of other culturally as well. What about the submarine situation today?
Well, we have Collins-class boats now, six of those. And they were much, you know, derided and scorned when they arrived. And they did have a lot of teething troubles. There is no doubt about that. Mm. But in the beginning, the news media were full of headlines like dud subs and all that sort of stuff. And they did have teething problems. They were too noisy and they had to be sort of reshaped and so on to sort of cut down the noise and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But they have proved to be fantastically useful boats. They're also in the intelligence gathering game. And they have had a remarkable record over the years they've been in service. Now, they're going to have to go for a few more years yet till they get this AUKUS thing together. Mm. But the Collins-class boats have been extraordinarily successful part of our defence. Mm. See, yeah, the funny thing, isn't it funny, you know, we Australians, we tend to think of ourselves as, you know, kookaburras and gum trees in the bush and, you know, the outback and the wide open spaces and all right. that sort of thing. But we are, in fact, a maritime nation. We are surrounded by three of the world's great oceans, the Pacific Ocean, the Southern Ocean, and the Indian Ocean. Mm. No other country can boast that pretty much. And we rely on the sea for our very livelihood. Our economy depends on the things we sell overseas by sea and the things we import by sea. You know, cars and petrol, diesel, have been just two things that we need to get in by sea. Without them, we're lost. So we are a maritime nation, and our sea defences are of critical importance.
For anyone out there listening that wants to engage in a history of our seafaring ways, then certainly this book would be a good way to start it. So thank you so much, Mike, for appearing on the Last Post Radio Show podcast series.
Mate, thank you for inviting me. That's very kind of you. I'm glad to be here.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show.